Kimberly Atkins Store, in for Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Summer 2021 is nothing like summer 2020. Airports are busy, bars and restaurants are open for dining outdoors and in. People are hitting the gym unmasked, and yet the pandemic is still here. After months of decline, COVID cases are rising again. Many of the new hotspots are in places with low vaccination rates. A whopping 99.5% of deaths due to COVID-19 are among the unvaccinated. And researchers at Georgetown University have identified five regions in the United States where clusters of people who've not been vaccinated are likely to drive further outbreaks. They're all in the South and Southeast. This hour on Point, we will drill down on the political polarization and access issues that are driving down vaccination rates and driving up COVID cases. Joining me now from Nashville, Tennessee, is Dr. Bill Schaffner, Medical Director of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Dr. Schaffner, welcome back to On Point.
Hello, Kimberly. Good to be with you.
So I want to just talk a little bit about what is causing the situation that we are in. Is it this Delta variant that is pushing it? Is it people being reluctant to get vaccinated? Both? Where are we and why are we here?
Well, Kimberly, I'm afraid it's both. First of all, the Delta variant is out there. It is very, very contagious, so it spreads very, very readily. And what it's doing is homing in on people who are unvaccinated, because the vaccines provide excellent protection against this Delta variant. So it's circulating now among the population that still has not availed themselves of the vaccine. And in some parts of the country, my own state of Tennessee included, there are large areas of the state that are substantially under-vaccinated. Lots of people still susceptible. If you look at our hospitals, the admissions for COVID are striking. They're essentially only among unvaccinated people.
And so speaking of that, and we will get to a little later about the reasons people may not want to get the vaccine, but I have seen in some places where, as you said, you have these rising infection rates, but there are also fairly high vaccination rates too, which gives me the question, is this problem with the vaccine spreading among the unvaccinated also a problem for vaccinated people?
Well, it obviously does affect some vaccinated people, but it's keeping them out of the hospital. The vaccines are, because that's what the vaccines were intended to do, to avert, to prevent really serious illness. Now, we also hoped that the vaccines would prevent complete infection, and they do indeed reduce the likelihood of infection and make it much less likely that a vaccinated person could transfer the virus to someone else, but it's not zero. So we do see some spread among vaccinated people, but as long as they don't get into the hospital, well, that's a success.
And so with this, I just want to be clear, we'll talk about a little more about this later, but is there a danger? What is the biggest risk, not just to vaccinated, unvaccinated people? Are you afraid of more mutations? Are we afraid that this will cause the need for further lockdowns or restrictions? What's the fear here among people who are opting not to get vaccinated in getting this, in spreading this, in these rise in cases?
Well, clearly the first set of consequences are people becoming unnecessarily ill. Essentially, all the hospitalizations due to COVID that are occurring today are potentially preventable. That's a very striking fact. The second is this virus is spreading among unvaccinated people. It reproduces billions of times every time it infects a new person. And of course, when it does that, it mutates. When it mutates, there's the potential for creating new variants. So that is, of course, a parallel concern. Down the road, I don't think that new lockdowns are on the menu in the future. I don't think our population would accept them.
Yeah. So I want to pause for a minute. And joining us also from Tennessee, from Franklin, Tennessee, is Dr. Michelle Fiskus. Until Monday this week, she was the top vaccine official for the Tennessee Department of Health. But Dr. Fiskus says she was fired that day in retaliation against her promotion of information on vaccinations for teenagers. Dr. Fiskus, thank you for joining us on Point.
Thanks so much for having me with you.
So tell us what happened. How were you giving information to teenagers, which what you said, as you said, led to the loss of your job?
Well, what I gave was a memo to the providers in our state who were providing COVID-19 vaccines that explained the mature minor doctrine in Tennessee, which is case law from Tennessee Supreme Court from 1987. So it's been in effect here in Tennessee for 34 years. I had some of our COVID-19 providers reaching out to me asking what they should do if a minor were to present to them requesting a vaccine but not be accompanied by their parent. And this was on the cusp of the authorization for the Pfizer vaccine down to age 12. So I reached out to our Office of General Counsel at Tennessee Department of Health and asked them for language around the mature minor doctrine, which I was provided. And I was told that that had already been posted to our website, which it has been, was told that the language had been blessed by the governor's office and told that I could share that information with whomever I chose. So I copied and pasted that information into a memo that went out to our COVID-19 providers with a short preamble just saying, that with Pfizer vaccine becoming authorized for children 12 and up, I thought it would be helpful to have an understanding of Tennessee's mature minor doctrine. Unfortunately, some recipients of that memo felt that I had sent it out to undermine the authority of parents rather than sharing what is in Tennessee case law, and posted it to social media. It got attention of some of our anti-vaccine folks in Tennessee. Legislators were called and eventually culminated in the calling of the Department of Health before the State Government Operations Committee, where members of that committee actually called for the dissolution of the state's Department of Health as a result of that memo and some social media posts that had been put out by the governor's office and TDH explaining that COVID-19 vaccine is available for children ages 12 and older.
So you're saying that there were calls that the entire department be shut down because, as you said, you were giving information about vaccines that the FDA has said can be given to children as young as 12, and also information about the mature minor doctrine, as you said, was the law before the pandemic.
That's right. Yeah, that for sharing that information and for sharing information with the public that COVID-19 vaccines are available for children 12 and older, that, yes, we had legislators that called for the dismantling of the state's Department of Health.
So what is your reaction to this? I assume that you were surprised that your move to give this information led, as you allege, to your dismissal.
Well, I was horrified, for one, that that anyone elected to serve and protect the people of Tennessee would call for the dissolving of the state's public health agency amidst a pandemic. It's ludicrous that would even be suggested. I think what's bothered me the most is that the reaction of the leadership of Tennessee Department of Health to this saber rattling by some of these legislators is to now pull back on all of our outreach activities, initially for COVID-19 vaccine, and that we were told to cancel all adolescent facing COVID-19 vaccination events that had been scheduled, to no longer message COVID-19 vaccinations about adolescents, to no longer send out reminder cards to adolescents who may have received their first dose but not received their second yet. And then that devolved into no messaging around vaccinations of any kind to children of any age. So immunizations for infants, back to school immunizations. We are about 30,000 doses of MMR vaccine behind right now because of the pandemic, because parents were afraid to go seek healthcare for their children, or their providers may not have even been available to them because of PPE shortages initially, or the Department of Health not being available to vaccinate their children because they were doing pandemic response work. To not be sending out messages around HPV vaccine in a state that has one of the highest HPV cancer rates in the entire country. So all of these activities have been pulled back now. And essentially the only way for a child to get a vaccination is going to be physically to come to a health department because we can no longer even provide them in school-based vaccination clinics.
Wow. Well, Dr. Fiscus, until this week, the top vaccine official for the Tennessee Department of Health, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
We reached out to the Tennessee Department of Health to comment on Dr. Fiscus's departure, and they told us they could not discuss personnel matters. I want to go back to you, Dr. Schaffner, just in the few seconds before our break. The fact that no vaccine information is being given out by the state's Department of Health, what's your reaction to that?
Well, I'm chairman of the Shelley Fiscus fan club, and I'm very disappointed that she was let go. I think we have to, just as Shelley said, renew our efforts to get information out and get these children in vaccinated for routine vaccines as well as COVID vaccine.
We are talking this hour about the slowing vaccination rates across the United States and what that means for the country's fight against the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. We're talking this hour about the divide between regions with high and low vaccination rates and the rise of the Delta variant. Dr. Bill Schaffner joins me. He is medical director of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Dr. Schaffner, I want to pick up where we left off before the break about the need for information. I'm sure that is one thing that is important to encourage more people to get vaccinated. And also, in this case, in the previous segment, we were talking about young people. But who are the people, as you see it, there in Tennessee and beyond, who are opting not to get vaccinated?
There are a variety of reasons that people are not choosing to be vaccinated. There are folks who literally want more information. And then there are a lot of people who are still not comfortable. You know, psychologists have told us, and we'll hear from Dr. Hunsinger in just a minute, that information is important, but it's not sufficient to change behavior. We need to make people feel comfortable and reassured. Their quote-unquote attitude about immunization is very, very important. What are their peers doing? So we need people who look like them, who come from their communities, who are leaders, respected, and who have the community's trust to go out there and try to persuade them to get vaccinated.
And is access still a problem now? I know in the beginning when we had these discussions, it was a major problem in certain parts of the country. But now, is it mostly a matter of choice, or are we still seeing some places where access is a problem?
I'm sure there are still some places where access is a problem, but at least in our communities here, we have abundant vaccine in the refrigerators, in the freezers, but they're Those vaccines are not moving into arms. As a friend of mine likes to say, vaccines never prevented any disease. Vaccination does. So we have to move the vaccine into arms. Yes, in some rural areas and perhaps still in some central cities, perhaps access is not optimal. But really, health departments under Dr. Fiskus's leadership have really been trying to reach out to those populations.
Okay. And as you mentioned, joining us now from Chicago is Jeff Hunsinger, a social psychologist at Loyola University Chicago. He studied the philosophy of people who refuse vaccines. Jeff, welcome to On Point.
Hi. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, please go on.
I was going to say, we were talking about knowledge. And so historically, vaccine hesitancy and resistance has been assumed to be a knowledge or education problem. Simply provide people with information about vaccine safety and effectiveness, and they'll embrace vaccination. However, from a lot of research, we know it's incredibly difficult to change attitudes towards vaccination, and that interventions that focus on vaccine knowledge to change vaccine attitudes are often short-term or do not work. And so in the research that I've conducted with my colleagues, we've sort of taken this apparent resistance of vaccine hesitancy to intervention to suggest that it may be rooted in what are called deeper moral intuitions that guide individual decision making and that are kind of difficult to change. And so what we found in our research is that two sort of moral intuitions or moral foundations strongly predicted vaccine hesitancy. And these were purity and liberty. And purity is about sanctity and avoiding contamination of ourselves. We are to avoid disgusting things or acts that are unnatural. And liberty is about valuing individual freedom and liberties while resenting people or groups who restrict those freedoms and liberties. And so we found that those were strongly predictive of anti-vaccine attitudes and hesitancy among individuals. And if you look to now with COVID and go to anti-vaccine websites or the messaging you see on social media or memes or whatever, you'll see phrases that map onto purity and liberty foundations among these groups. So anti-vaccine groups and individuals will call the mRNA vaccines, quote unquote, experimental gene therapy, right? Somehow unnatural. They'll talk about contaminants and toxins in the vaccine. And they'll do things like favor, quote unquote, natural immunity rather than immunity gained through vaccination because that is somehow better because it is natural, right? And this is all the language of purity and contamination and the idea that we should avoid anything that's disgusting or unnatural, right?
Right.
And for the Liberty Foundation, you see anti-vaccine individuals and groups forced vaccine movement.
We're having a little bit of trouble hearing from Jeff, and so we'll pause for a moment just to see if we can get that connection back together. But I want to go back to you, Dr. Schaffner, just a little bit of what we heard about this idea of people either objecting to something that is impure or might cause some sort of unnatural reaction, or these values of liberty. Are these the kinds of things that you are hearing when among people who are reluctant to get the vaccine?
Well, I was smiling when I heard Dr. Hunsinger speak because that conforms exactly with the sorts of things that we are hearing. So it's not facts so much, it's how you feel about things. And as he pointed out, these are deeply held beliefs. And look at where the whole issue of liberty comes in contrast or in conflict even with the virus. The virus is contagious. So it's not just about your individual decision, because your decision actually affects others around you. So it's not just about you. You know, being unvaccinated, I would say, is quite analogous to coming to a red light and keeping on driving. Yes, you put yourself at risk. That's your choice. But you also put other people at risk. So in order to combat the virus, we all have to work together and give up some of our individual decision-making so that the entire community can be protected. This is tough for some people.
Yeah. So we think we have Jeff Hunsinger back. Thank you for hanging in with us there, Jeff. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
No problem. So I want to get to this idea that because of these objections that are based on either purity or liberty, Is there sort of two Americas developing among the vaccinated and unvaccinated based on these principles?
Yeah. The one interesting thing is that you see the political polarization of anti-vaccine attitudes or hesitancy heavily, you know, conservative states are have the lowest vaccination rates, whereas more liberal states have the highest. What's also interesting is that those states that have the lowest vaccination rates are also those states that have populations that are higher in liberty and purity as well. So that can help explain some of the divide going on here. And because this is rooted in moral intuitions, at least in part, can explain why the rhetoric or the discussion surrounding vaccines is so heated and, you know, causes so many problems and is also very difficult to change.
Now, is it more complex than that, Jeff? I mean, I'm thinking back, for example, when we had the Ebola scare a few years back, and there were a lot of folks, including Republican conservative leaders, who wanted to impose really severe restrictions, really, you know, stop people at the airport when they came from countries where Ebola was spreading. How do you square those two things?
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's nothing specific to, you know, being a conservative or a liberal that should, you know, pushes people to be for or against you know, vaccination or public health more generally. What's going on here in some sense is that the public health measures taken during the pandemic, including masks and now vaccination, have been politicized. And so now you have, you know, one group seeing this as something that's associated with the other political party. And so you have what's called negative partisanship driving a lot of this as well, where with negative partisanship, if the group likes something, then I will hate it. So if conservatives think that liberals like vaccination or are in favor of it, negative partisanship will push them to be against it. And so that's, you know, part of the dynamic here as well.
And I just, and also just talking about the complexities of it, does it go beyond that? Like, I've spoken to some young people, young Black Americans who are certainly not conservative, other folks who are more conservative, but who aren't really hyper-partisan. And they talk about things that they may have heard, fears about, for example, how a vaccine may affect a woman's reproductive health or other things. Is it also a factor of just mere miscommunication and misinformation about what's in these vaccines?
Yes, it's all of these things. And there's a lot of misinformation about the, you know, the safety of the vaccines themselves that's swirling around that is influencing people's risk assessments or judgments about should I get the vaccine? Is it more dangerous than COVID and so forth? And so that's feeding into it as well. You know, like you were saying, anti-vaccine attitudes or hesitancy are multi-determined. There are many factors pushing into it, and they'll be different depending upon which population you're looking at and also depending upon, you know, the historic context. And so, yeah, there's many things that are driving it.
So, Dr. Schaffner, how do health officials like you, how do other leaders, how do members, general members of the public who are vaccinated and who want others to be too, fight against this? Is it just a matter, not just, but is it a matter of the words that we use and how we talk about the vaccine?
I think it's very important how we talk about the vaccine, and I would avoid the verb fight. I think what we're trying to do is persuade, comfort, reassure, and trying to get people who are very similar to the population that has an adverse sense of the vaccine and get them, locally respected people, I think over time probably will be most persuasive or most successful in persuading people who are similar to them in their own communities to come forward and be vaccinated. I don't think it's easy, and I think it will take a long time. I'd be fascinated to hear what Jeff has to say.
Well, Jeff, I want to ask specifically because there are efforts at a local level to do things like have folks go door to door to try to be persuasive in a way that Dr. Schaffner is talking about and urge people to get the vaccine and fight against this. I'm sorry to use the word fight, but to tamp down this misinformation about the vaccine. But at the other hand, if somebody's knocking on your door, that might feed into this idea of liberty as a moral intuition. Sort of talk about that dichotomy there.
Yeah, the going door to door has already been politicized, right? You have political pundits or, you know, members of Congress railing against it and making obscene sort of comparisons. I do think that the door to door small conversations where you take seriously people's concerns about the vaccine are probably the best way to go about doing this. We know from political science research and prejudice reduction research that, you know, this door to door canvassing where you share personal stories, maybe how you came around to getting a vaccine, maybe you were hesitant at first, but sharing, you know, your personal vaccine journey, I guess you could say, with individuals while you canvass going door to door might be quite effective. We know that those sort of conversations which get personal, where you talk to someone, discuss their fears, their concerns, and so forth, are effective at changing anti-trans attitudes as well as other biases and prejudices that are out there.
Yeah. So, Jeff, how do you talk about actual real facts, not misinformation, that may have scared people? For example, the pause in the Johnson & Johnson vaccine was concerning to a lot of people. New evidence that there could be a link with some neurological problems in the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, things of that sort. Not misinformation, but facts. How do you treat those?
Yeah, I think you take people's fears seriously when discussing those. Yes, there is a small, you know, slight chance of this negative or adverse event following vaccination, but you can compare it to sort of risks that people take in everyday life, right? It's smaller than the risk of getting into an accident and ending up in the hospital, for example. And just expressing empathy. I understand, you know, why you feel this way. But here's another way of understanding that risk and putting that risk into context. The other thing you can do is sort of highlight and take advantage of the moral roots of anti-vaccine attitudes by highlighting that getting the vaccine is one way to purify your body against the contaminating virus or something along those lines, or talking about the vaccine as a way to get your liberty back, get your freedom back, and so forth.
All right, Jeff Hunsinger, professor of social psychology at Loyola University Chicago. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Dr. Schaffner, I want to talk a little bit more about the flare-ups of infection rates that we are seeing in certain places and ask you about breakthrough infections. I know we talked at the top about how people who are vaccinated, that the vaccine is working to keep them out of the hospital, to keep them healthy and to keep them alive. But what about breakthroughs? You know, I want to visit my parents who are in their 80s. I've been vaccinated and so have they. But I worry. I think about this before I see them. What should people know about that?
Well, I think, first of all, Kimberly, we need to have confidence in the vaccines. They are extraordinarily successful, not 100%, 95% at best. And in that kind of meeting that you will have with your parents, I think you can both take your masks off and be really very comfortable that the risk is extraordinarily low. Now, there is a population of people who are immunocompromised for a variety of reasons. They're taking a medicine that compromises, that suppresses their immune system, or they have an underlying illness. And those folks may not have an optimal response to the vaccine. And my suggestion to them is to, continue to be careful, because should they become infected, they're more likely to become ill. Take the belt and suspenders approach. Yes, you're vaccinated, but if you're out in groups outside, these immunocompromised folks, still keep your distance, wear your mask, and so you can have a double layer of protection.
And right now we are seeing pockets of areas where we're seeing this rise in infection rates. But what about travel? Is travel, planes are full now. Is travel a risk that could spread these pockets further across the country?
Certainly on aircraft, with everyone still masked, the risk from that actual travel experience is low. It may be different in trains and buses. because the air handling is not as clean and precise. And of course, it depends on what you're going to do, where you're traveling, as to what your risk will be.
Okay, well, hold right there for a moment. We're looking behind the recent trends in vaccination rates and COVID-19 cases to understand where we are in the race against the pandemic. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. We're discussing the divide between the vaccinated and the unvaccinated in the U.S. Alabama has one of the lowest vaccination rates in the United States. Just 33.3% of its residents are fully vaccinated. Stephanie McClure is a professor of biocultural medical anthropology at the University of Alabama. As a lead investigator for Communivax, a national initiative to improve vaccine equity, Professor McClure has conducted research to understand vaccination rates in the Black community in Alabama. She and her national partners found that many who have not received the vaccine are, quote, vaccine impeded.
Unequal access, unequal quality of health care is a present day reality. It is not the case that this is something that people are recalling simply from their memory or who have, you know, sort of heard about, passed down in tales. People are evoking these historical incidents like the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, let's just get it out there, as a kind of metonym for ongoing unequal access and unequal treatment.
Professor McClure points to examples within her own team. Here's what happened when one of her research assistants, a Black woman, tried to get vaccinated.
When she went to get her vaccination, she was asked by the person administering the vaccine what qualified her to get vaccinated. And another student, another graduate student of mine who's not associated with the project but who happens to be Taiwanese, had the same experience. And in fact, when I asked the white GTAs about that experience, none of them reported that.
McClure says that given these barriers to access, convincing more folks to get vaccinated takes time.
Making the vaccine available, keeping it available, pulling down those barriers to access, making it easy for people to do it, right? Those are all things that can help to overcome hesitancy. We say fight hesitancy with access.
That was Stephanie McClure, anthropology professor at the University of Alabama and lead investigator for Communivax, a national initiative to improve vaccine equity. And we are still joined by Dr. Schaffner. So, Dr. Schaffner, we talked a little bit about access before, but we see here that access can mean different things, right? I'm a Black woman, and there are times in the medical, when I go see a doctor, I'm not always sure that they're taking my concerns seriously. And I think that is an issue that has caused some distrust of the medical community among Black communities. How do we talk about that and try to guard against that kind of access denial?
Well, Kimberly, I think we have to recognize its validity and recognize it has historical precedence. And as Professor McClure said, it is still with us today. And we have to do everything we can to recognize our great diversity in this country and recognize that everyone out there, all of our patients, everyone coming in for our vaccine is a person. And those persons should be respected, and they should get the best medical care, preventive health services, and certainly access to these vaccines in a very straightforward fashion. I think we have to keep raising our sensitivity and our recognition of that. Unless we recognize it, we can't do anything about it.
All right. We've received a lot of listener feedback and questions. And I want to get to a message that we received from a listener on the South Shore of Massachusetts who's concerned about transmission among children under 12.
The story is yesterday dropped my son off for what was meant to be an outdoor baseball camp with about 100 other 9-year-olds, well, kids between 9 and probably 6 and 12. And because it was raining, the camp decided to move the event inside into a gymnasium. There must have been 100 kids in the gym, no masks, and I think I was the only parent who was worried. I sent my kid in with a mask. He said there was only one other kid in there with a mask.
So, Dr. Schaffner, what do you make of that? Not only the concerns that she had protecting her child, but also being aware that her child is the only one in there not wearing a mask and the issues that presents. How do parents navigate this?
Well, that's a distressing story, Kimberly, because there obviously was no plan B. People didn't think ahead. There should have been provision for a rainy day with the provision of masks and activities that would keep the kids more separate in that gymnasium. And I think the individual parents who are there do the best they can in that kind of circumstance. You don't want to get into any conflict with people, but just in a positive and friendly way say, well, we're doing all the best we can to keep everyone safe and prevent and encourage the children to wear masks.
And just related to that, the fall is fast approaching. School will return. And people under 12 are still not vaccinated in the country. More generally, what should parents be thinking about? Should they be concerned about kids going back into the classroom? And what should they do?
Well, obviously, their concern is justified. They ought to inquire what their school is doing for children, particularly under the age of 12, who are not yet qualified for the vaccine. You know, wearing masks, keeping the students separate, working in smaller groups. Some schools have had staggered start and stop times to reduce the crowding. How are they handling luncheons? A lot of students are not going at the same time to lunch, and some of the lunches have been brought into the classroom. Are all the adults and the older students in that school vaccinated? That and many other things, disinfection, what are they doing regarding attention to ventilation? All of those things schools have had a chance to implement. Not every school can do everything, but every school should do some things to try to reassure parents and to keep the risk very low. I do believe we can send our children at very low risk to schools this fall.
Okay. Well, we received this question from a listener about vaccination rates worldwide.
My name is Alex Koh. I live from South Pasadena. My question is regarding the coronavirus and vaccines. As we struggle in this country to reach herd immunity through vaccination, what hope is there, even if we reach that, if only 2 or 3% of the rest of the world is vaccinated? Doesn't that eventually create variants that'll pierce our vaccinations that we have now? How will we surmount this problem if we can't get the rest of the world vaccinated?
Doctor, what do you think about that?
Well, Alex does have the correct global perspective. It is a pandemic, which means that it's a global epidemic. And he's right on point. You know, if this virus keeps multiplying in people who live in other countries, there's every likelihood that new variants will be created. And the risk is that some of these new variants may be able to evade the protection of our vaccines, and then we'd have to create a new vaccine and start all over again. So we're obliged, and we are already, as Americans, helping out internationally. But we do have to think of this as a global pandemic and do even more to make vaccines available around the world. It's a very small world. These viruses don't require passports. They travel very readily.
And I sort of want to close out our conversation a little bit by focusing on a few more questions about what people can do besides getting vaccinated. People who are not vaccinated can do that. But people who are vaccinated, there's still a lot of conflicting guidance about wearing masks indoors in places, stores, restaurants, for example. What advice would you give there?
Well, I always distinguish the people who have normal immune systems from those folks who are a bit more fragile and have impaired immune systems. The latter should indeed, as I like to say, use the belt and suspenders approach. Be especially careful. They know about wearing masks when they're indoors with other large groups of people. Whereas the people who are vaccinated, they can, I think, take great confidence in the protection that they have from their vaccines and be much freer in what it is that they do. Of course, if you're on the more cautious side, take a few more precautions. There's nothing wrong with that.
And what about boosters? I know Dr. Anthony Fauci said that it is too early, that is something that he said that it's something that Americans should not worry about yet. What does that yet mean? And what factors may influence that yet?
Yeah, Kimberly, that's the question of the day. I think the answer is not yet. Let's think for a moment. There are two reasons that we would want to start using boosters. One is if the protection from our current vaccine starts to wane. Actually, we're out to 8-9 months and beyond to 1 year, and the protection seems to be holding up. So there's no reason to do a booster for that. And the other would be those variants we just mentioned. Are there variants that can evade the protection of our current vaccines? And the answer is not yet. Our vaccines do protect against the variants that are circulating today. So it's wonderful to have boosters available on the shelf, already improved, if we need them, but we don't need them yet. We ought to focus on all of our neighbors and friends who have not yet been vaccinated. Those are the folks where the vaccine ought to go at the present time.
And with that, I suppose, aside from people in the community and the door-to-door outreach that we've seen, there are listeners, I'm sure, who have loved ones who have not yet been vaccinated. What do you encourage them to say as they gather over the summer to them?
Always respect their concerns and then ask them specifically what bothers them, and then try to provide them, as I say, reassurance and comfort, and talk to them, as Jeff suggested, in language that they understand, to try to persuade them to come on over to the bright side and be vaccinated and protected.
All right. That is Dr. Bill Schaffner. He's the medical director of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Dr. Schaffner, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
Always a great pleasure, Kimberly.
We've been looking back at the past 16 months of the pandemic by reaching out to guests who joined On Point throughout 2020. And we want to take a moment now to catch up with the Reverend Joshua Lawrence Lazard. He joined us last year to talk about how faith communities across America were worshiping together during the coronavirus outbreak.
When I spoke with WBUR last time, I was working at Duke University. I was since laid off. So it has been a year of moves, a year of readjustment, a year of you know, attempting to continue to maintain some relationships with people from my previous, you know, employment, and still trying to make new social engagements with people here in the city of Boston.
It was also a year that saw Reverend Lazard lose a beloved family member.
I had an aunt that died. We knew that she had had her bouts with cancer throughout the last few years. And she eventually moved to hospice care toward the end of last year. And she lived in Houston. This was an aunt I would have, you know, moved heaven and earth to try and attend the funeral, to be with family and whatnot. And I will never forget sitting down in my chair to watch the funeral live stream. And it was that moment in which the pandemic, you know, I'm not going to say came full circle, but, you know, yet one more layer of reality of what the pandemic has robbed from everyone became manifested. That to me was a very hard moment. It was just one of those real moments of sadness within the pandemic. I have elderly parents, and I was worried about them. I was legitimately worried about them because they were in, quote unquote, this danger zone of being highly susceptible to COVID. And I definitely remember many nights praying in the early parts of COVID, as we're hearing, you know, these waves happening, certainly here on the East Coast, in New York, but again, you know, waves happening in Chicago. And I turned back to things that were familiar. I turned back to prayer. I turned back to conversations with my friends who are in faith communities to just talk these things through. And yes, as a result, I do believe that my faith got strengthened, got reaffirmed throughout this. I have partnered with a local church here in Boston throughout the summer. And, you know, they are, you know, discussing those things about what does this need to look like when we get back together. And I'm pretty sure this is the case, you know, across the religious spectrum, you know, for at least, you know, religious communities that meet with some level of regularity week to week. Those 5-year plans that we, you know, that churches and synagogues might have had, you know, for the future, they're going to need to go back to the drawing board because priorities have changed. Expectations have changed. It's the reality that, you know, now, you know, houses of worship now truly have national audiences. It's trying to figure out the difference between, do we stay on Zoom once we return to in-person, you know, worship? Do we have a live stream that we once never did a year ago because we didn't think it was important? How do we bring people who might be tuning into us from Phoenix, Arizona now, or Seattle, Washington? I would say that to keep the faith as you see it, that we are definitely stronger together. I believe that as a whole, as a country, we have appealed to our better angels. And I think that us as a country, we will be better for it.
That was Reverend Joshua Lazard, who is now at the Tech Theology School at Boston University. Both of his parents and the Reverend have been vaccinated, and he's planning a trip to see them in Chicago this month. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.